It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Okay, we are talking today with Professor Peter Cole. We had a conversation with Peter, I believe, was it last year or was it the year before that?
Last year.
And our discussion then was about kind of the global history of the industrial workers of the world, and we talked about some great stuff, great history. We're going to be talking today specifically about multiracial struggle, about dock workers in particular in two key ports. It's the San Francisco Bay Area and also, what's the other place if you want to pronounce it correctly?
Durban, South Africa.
And we're going to be talking about how historically workers have fought against racism and white supremacy, and particularly apartheid, how they have been involved in global struggles through their workplace, and also just about kind of the radical history of these spots of resistance and everything that goes into that. And give us the title of the book.
Of course, it's called Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah, and we got the blurb for this and it looks really fascinating. We're really excited to talk about this. There's some really key questions, you know, everything from, you know, how are people going to mobilize against automation to how do people come together in the face of racism and white supremacy and create a class struggle politics. So we're just going to dive into it. So what caused you to write about this topic? You know, why write this book?
Sure. Well, it's a random subject. I appreciate. I actually wrote a book some years ago. My first book was on it was about Philadelphia dock workers who were part of the IWW, the Wobblies, in the early 20th century. And I was interested in that because I was interested in basically how working class people could overcome racism, xenophobia, and the like to form powerful unions, which I saw as sort of the most powerful social movements of working people. However, after I finished that book, I found myself sort of still interested in the subject. And along the way, working on my first book, I came across the San Francisco Bay Area dock workers who are members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Local 10 is the San Francisco Bay local. And, well, they're fascinating. And so I ended up wanting to write a second book on dock workers, which was not my intention. Although this second book is much more focused on the industry as opposed to just the Wobblies, was that book ended up really being a lot about the IWW. And I also sort of, just to be crazy, wanted to sort of globalize myself and ended up working on another port in Durban in southern Africa that also has a somewhat similar history of militant dock workers fighting against racial oppression, as well as some other similarities. And so, even though it seems very obscure, I understand, it actually opens up, I hope, important conversations about subjects that, in fact, people across the world and whatever the sort of work we do might be interested in.
Awesome. You know, you wrote in the extract for the book that the book is specifically about, quote, the history of two important groups of dock workers in two vital ports in San Francisco and in Durban. And San Francisco and Oakland was the largest port on the West Coast through the 1970s, remained significant in many ways. Durban actually is the busiest port in sub-Saharan Africa and has been for decades. So what about these ports makes them significant, either in terms of just historical significance or in terms of the global economy?
Sure. Well, so I tell people all the time that if you think about what is the most important city in your opinion or the greatest cities, Many of the great cities around the world, not just in the U.S. and South Africa, are in fact port cities. London, New York, Los Angeles, Hamburg, Hong Kong, Singapore, the list goes on. A lot of us don't think about it in that way. But in fact, it's because of this industry, shipping, which for the last 500 years at least has been the single most important industry in the entire world and to capitalism, drives basically the world. Right. And so these places, in fact, are central nodes of global capital, but also are places where there's been resistance to that, because these ports, of course, are inhabited by human beings, and many of us human beings work. And those who work in the ports are regularly interacting with people from other parts of the world, are learning news about other parts of the world, are exchanging ideas with people who have been involved maybe in organizing in other parts of the world. Not only are these two places central to their own metropolitan areas and countries in terms of economics, right? They're also places that have become incredibly diverse in terms of ideas and cultures. And believe it or not, if you live in the Bay Area and you don't know the centrality of the dock workers and their union, you literally don't understand the place that you live, nor do you understand why the place that you live has this long history and present of radicalism. So going back to the 1840s, San Francisco, then by in the 1960s and 70s, Oakland will grow as a port, will be driving many of the changes that are happening locally, but also beyond the metropolitan areas. It's the people who work in the port who, unbeknownst to the average person, in fact, have tremendous power, but also are central to what's happening to the local economies, but also to local political activism.
So one of the things I think is interesting is you wrote that dock workers are well aware of their role in the global economy and their ability to shut it down if they want to. Did you find this through their own writings, through their speeches, or through their actions, or is it all of it? You know, is it just intrinsic knowledge that people know that they have this ability, or is it something that they learn through struggle?
Well, it's both. It's all of the above. But I could just read you the quote that's sort of the first in my book. This comes from Lou Goldblatt, who was the second in command of the West Coast dock workers for many decades, second to Harry Bridges, who's a much more famous figure. The shipping industry has a feature that should never be underestimated. The economic power of the longshoremen is fantastic compared to most workers, the amount of leverage they have. So basically, there's two phrases that many of us are familiar with that help us understand that. One is time is money. The other is the ship must sail on time. Now, although in general in business, time literally is money because you pay workers by the hour, right? And you might rent, say, a slip where your ship is docked, right? And so on. Everybody knows this, right? Employers know it. Those who hire ships to move their stuff know it. And the workers know it, right? Of course, in the process of working in this industry, they become much more aware of their importance and centrality. But even if they didn't know that beforehand, it becomes, yeah, very clear, as you said, through struggle. But, you know, in the Marxist terms, essentially, they do develop a consciousness on the job. That also includes a collective consciousness as opposed to an individual consciousness, because historically, for millennia, workers worked in pairs and in gangs in order to move, to load and unload cargo. You can't load a ship by yourself. And so if, of course, you know that, and if, of course, you have this sort of potential power, stopping work, which is, of course, what we call a strike, is the way to immediately impact the pocketbooks of employers and shippers. And so these folks get that, right? Like, now, of course, it's only if you're organized, right? You might know that this industry is really important, but if you're not well organized among your fellow workers, whether it's in a formal union or even informally, well, then you can't exert that power. One person alone can't stop a ship. Everybody has to work together. But nevertheless, they sort of appreciate this quite well. And of course, employers in particular, this is why employers are one of the main reasons they're so anti-union, right? Is because they fear potential worker power. And as the Wobblies used to say, Big Bill Haywood, right? The most powerful thing a worker can do is put his hands in his pockets, right? Meaning right. Stop work. Now, related to that and sort of a very interesting, I don't know if it's a factoid or not, but literally the term strike has maritime origins. So back in the 1760s, in the port of London, which at that time was the greatest port in the world, busiest port in the world, sailors and others who worked on the docks on the River Thames wanted a raise. So what they did is, as sailors, is they took down the sails of their ships so it could not move. Now, in maritime or nautical terms, to take down your sails is to strike the sails. And subsequently, because of that incident in 1768, that action became synonymous with workers stopping work, period, not just workers on ships. So that also, of course, is some sort of clue into the centrality of the maritime world, shipping, to capitalism, right? And so although the great majority of people who work never have are unaware of the origins, the maritime origins of this term, it also is a clue, right, of how important this industry is in the past, but even in the 21st century too, because, well, 90% of the stuff we still consume is moved at least part of its way by ship.
Wow, that's fascinating. I didn't know that at all.
Most people don't.
Now, you know, a lot of what we're going to be talking about is kind of the struggle against racism within these unions and dock workers specifically. But I think that we need to kind of comment at least on the role of dock workers in some of the huge general strikes that swept across the United States. Can you just speak to those really quickly or as quickly as you want?
Yeah. Well, there's a long and fascinating history of the ILWU, both in terms of the Bay Area and the entire coast and in the Pacific. But in the 1930s, dock workers across the West Coast were largely non-union. They had unions in the past, but they had been broken after World War I in 1919 and thereabouts. And the 20s were hard times for workers and unions, but in the early 30s, during the Great Depression, workers became much more militant, including in San Francisco. And in 1934, dock workers in San Francisco, which was for a century already the busiest port on the West Coast, but also up and down the entire West Coast from Seattle down to Southern California, went on strike in what became known as the so-called Big Strike of 1934, that for over 2.5 months basically shut down the entire shipping industry on the West Coast. And out of the ashes of the Big Strike, right, a number of things occur. One, in San Francisco in July of 34, the Big Strike is sort of becomes a citywide general strike. When after police repression kills several people on July 5th, 1934, nicknamed Bloody Thursday in the lore of the ILWU, workers across the city and across the bay too, really, stop work in what's called a general strike, a citywide strike. They're very rare, but that was one of the most important ones, not the only one of that year. There was also one in the Twin Cities. And then a few years later, formally, this union is born, the ILWU, and with it, actually in 1934 and then onwards into the late 70s, the Australian immigrant, Harry Bridges, is the most well-known member. He becomes the first president of the ILWU. And is considered by many people to be essentially the most powerful left-wing union leader, or maybe for that matter, a leader in 20th century America, who was desperately hated by employers, but also was persecuted by the U.S. government for decades. My work doesn't focus primarily on Bridges, who people in the union still just call Harry, even though he died decades ago. If you say Harry to a dock worker on the West Coast, they know who you're talking about. But the history of that union more broadly is fascinating. My book is something of a history of the Bay Area and the union from the 1930s and 40s through the 70s and 80s, although it does focus primarily on their most large and most influential and most activist local, the Bay Area local 10. So that's maybe a thumbnail sketch of some of the context, for the book I've written.
Another quick question. How big was the influence of syndicalism on the ILWU? I know that historically they refused to kick out syndicalists. You know, there was criminal syndicalism laws. Also in South Africa, there was a large influence, to my understanding, of syndicalists and anarcho-syndicalist ideas. I'm just curious if you can comment on that.
Right. So if by syndicalists, we often mean sort of more anarchistic union folks, including but not only members of the industrial workers of the world. So the motto of the IWW is an injury to one is an injury to all. Guess what the motto is of the ILWU? guess what the motto is actually of the South African Federation of Labor called COSATU, as well as the South African Dock Workers Union today also. An injury to one is an injury to all. Now, that exact phrase, now the Wobblies, of course, sort of riffed off the Knights of Labor, an injury to one is a concern of all. But nevertheless, it shows us sort of the influence, as you say, of syndicalists. But in the 1930s and 40s, especially on the U.S. West Coast and the Northwest, from San Francisco on up, but down into L.A. also, there was a small but significant number of Wobblies and other syndicalists on ships and also in ports that then became part of the ILWU. And so, for instance, in Local 10, and also I believe other locals in the ILWU, you can't serve in an elected leadership position for more than 2 years. Right. You have to then rotate back into the rank and file. Right. And so that actually also was an old IWW thing where they were worried that essentially the elected leaders would become separate and distant from the members. And so although numerically we can't say honestly how many members of the IWW had been members of the IWW, the ideas are clearly stamped into the institution that the IWW becomes. In South Africa, there was also sort of in the early 1900s some syndicalist presence. Again, that's how that motto, which has a fascinating history crisscrossing Southern Africa throughout the 19-teens and 20s and then beyond. I wouldn't say that Durban dock workers are syndicalists in their overt consciousness, but they're sort of influenced by these currents that had existed, especially in the World War I era and into the 1920s across Southern Africa.
Yeah, and there's lots of other articles that have been written about the influence of syndicalism in South Africa, especially, and I encourage people to read that.
Yeah, especially by my friend Lucien van der Walt, who's written a great deal about South African syndicalism and anarchism. And we've worked together, but he also contributed a chapter to that anthology, Wobblies of the World, that I helped edit that came out last year.
Awesome. Yeah. And once again, if you haven't listened to that podcast discussion with Peter, go back and check it out. We'll definitely link it in this show. Well, we're going to switch gears a little bit here. You wrote in the preface for the book, you said the U.S. port workers played a role in the fight for racial equality. The fight for racial equality in the 30s and 40s. You know, in most of our, you know, thinking about things, it's not even until, you know, supposedly the 50s and the 60s, the civil rights movement kind of comes into being. I think the idea of unions playing a role in that struggle, I think, you know, would shock most Americans. Let's talk about this. How did they play a role in the fight for racial equality against white supremacy? What did they do and what did they engage in the 30s and the 40s?
Well, it's my pleasure. So in the 1930s, San Francisco and Oakland, for that matter, were incredibly white places, or at least have very few black people. I mean, in San Francisco, maybe 1% of the local population was African-American. In Oakland, maybe 3%. This is before the World War II era, when due to the second or so-called Great Migration, that, in fact, several hundred thousand African-Americans moved to the Bay Area in the 40s and 50s. But in the 30s, when the ILWU was born, 1934, during the big strike, the dock workers reached out to African-American dock workers. There was a small number who had actually entered the industry in 1919 as strikebreakers. And they didn't want, that is the strikers in 34, didn't want the same problem. So they reached out to black folks and said, we want you to be in this union. We want you to respect this strike, to be a part of the strike. They reached out to other black labor leaders. The most important was a man whose nephew was more famous. Ron Dellums' uncle was a guy named C.L. Dellums, who was actually the leader of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters for the West Coast and lived in Oakland. Got him on board. Right. And also after the strike, basically quickly integrated the work gangs, which previously had been segregated, meaning all black gangs or all white gangs, and also insisted upon racial equality so that in the 40s, the early 40s, when suddenly hundreds and then over 1,000 black men started working on the waterfront, they included them in the union. And then when they experienced discrimination, often from employers, including government employers and the U.S. Navy, members of the union, repeatedly basically criticized racial discrimination against their fellow members, fellow workers, in a very overt way. Now, why would you, these are only a few examples, but why would this 99% white workforce, and I'm not exaggerating those numbers, a diverse workforce among different white ethnic groups, but nevertheless 99% white, fight for racial equality starting in the 30s and 40s and then beyond? Well, there's two basic factors we might think about. One is pragmatic. We are stronger if we're united. But of course, pragmatism doesn't explain it alone, because time and time and time again, workers as well as non-workers have been divided based on race, nationality, as well as other things like gender, sexuality, and whatnot. Right. And so pragmatism alone doesn't explain it, because pragmatism, if that was the case, every union would be anti-racist. But in fact, many unions have been racist, or at least not very active in the struggle. So that takes us to the second factor, which is ideology. Many members of the ILWU, leaders as well as rank and file members, were left wing, right? Socialists, communists, Trotskyists, Wobblies, and other syndicalists. Not all, but many. They are anti-racist because they have an ideology that believes that in order to achieve more radical change, you very much want to be inclusive, because it doesn't matter what ethnic or racial group you're a part of or sex. It matters that you're a worker first. Again, that's not unique to the ILWU by any means, or even for that matter, 20th century left. This is in the 19th century. The Knights of Labor started to talk about some of this occasionally. But nevertheless, in the 30s and 40s, we see this immediately being present, especially among Bay Area Local 10. And as you said, a lot of people think of civil rights and the struggle for racial equality as a post-World War II effort in the 1950s and 60s. But nevertheless, the ILWU, but also some other unions that shared some things in common with the ILWU, like the United Electrical Workers, who are currently on strike in northwestern Pennsylvania and Erie, the UE. But these were unions that were part of a group called the CIO that was a breakaway from the AFL because they were more left-wing in their orientation in the 1930s. In the 50s, they actually reconnected, and so now we have the AFL-CIO. But in the 30s and 40s, the CIO is basically a more left-wing labor federation than the AFL. And so a bunch of unions, including but not only the ILWU, were organizing African-Americans, organizing Mexican-Americans, organizing women, and so on. And so they are actively fighting against racism, both within the ranks, but also increasingly pushing employers to be hiring black folks, pushing other unions, pushing then in the post-World War II era, whether it's the local, state, or national governments to end racial segregation. They gave a lot of support, financial and moral, to the Southern Civil Rights Movement. In fact, in 1963, Local 10 helped organize a march and rally in San Francisco during the spring of 63, during the Birmingham civil rights protests, where 30,000 people in San Francisco marched against racism. No one knows about that, but it was actually the largest civil rights march in the history of the Bay Area up until that point. And it was primarily organized by dock workers, including many of whom were African-American, but not only African-American. And so there is really this very fascinating and long and largely unknown history in the Bay Area in which the dock workers union are really, really using their worker power on behalf of other social movements and social justice causes. Although primarily my book focuses on their activism in the struggle for racial equality, as you said.
Wow. Thanks for laying that all out.
My pleasure.
So we've talked about the U.S. now. Let's talk about workers in South Africa. I mean, this, of course, could be it's a whole podcast in itself. But I think there's two components. How did workers there fight against apartheid? And then, of course, there is another history of workers, especially workers in the ILWU, linking up with workers in South Africa to engage in actions to fight against apartheid together in solidarity. And I know that actually that those links continue to today. I think the ILWU still continues to receive like delegations from South African unions in the U.S. Like they will come to the Bay Area and do events and stuff like that. But if you can just begin to talk about this very broad topic.
Well, of course, I'm happy to, and large parts of my book deal with some of these matters. Each of my chapters in my book explores simultaneously or side by side what's going on in Durban and San Francisco, and trying to sort of make connections to, but sort of at least sort of tease out parallels with. So in both the Bay Area and in Durban, across most of the 20th century, dock workers are fighting against racial oppression. In South Africa, the most widely known term is apartheid, which is an Afrikaans word. Afrikaans is sort of sort of derives from Dutch. And apartheid literally just means apartness, but more broadly means racial segregation. And as bad as racism was in 20th century America, including Jim Crow segregation, apartheid honestly was much worse. And we always keep in mind that in the U.S., in the generally speaking, like 12-13% of Americans are African Americans. But in South Africa, it's upwards of 80% of South Africans are Black Africans. Yeah. So in other words, the great majority of South Africans were oppressed by this perverse system called apartheid, which also could be South Africa's government was also really fascist. And so white supremacy and fascism often sort of go together. And so too in for much of 20th century South Africa. So in South Africa, jobs are segregated by race, meaning that by law, only one type of worker could work based on their racial category, white, Black, Indian or Asian, or colored, which is a term for mixed race peoples. There were four legal categories, racial categories, in apartheid South Africa. Pretty much all the dock workers in Durban were Black. Mostly were Zulus, which is an ethnic group in eastern South Africa, in KwaZulu, the region. And then some other peoples called Pandos, who speak Xhosa, but are sort of considered a separate group. Not all Xhosa speakers are the same. So what you've got in Durban is essentially 100% Black workforce, right? And in apartheid South Africa, Black workers had very few, if any, rights. They didn't have the right to form a union. They did not have the right to go on strike, etc. They also got paid terribly low wages. And so in South Africa, in Durban, which was by the early 20th century already the most important port in South Africa, surpassing Cape Town, these workers time and time again stop work in order to often, well, most logically, try to get higher wages. However, because of the perverse nature of South Africa, and really, you might say, the United States, we often use a term called racial capitalism to acknowledge that capitalism has really a sort of white supremacy as central to it. In South Africa, very much so, for Black workers to demonstrate power by striking, even if their demand is a wage demand, it is also, by definition, also a strike against apartheid. That was the way everybody understood it, including the state, including employers, which is why when Black workers would go on strike, literally the police and the army might be called in very quickly in order to suppress this, because the fear is that Black workers would empower other Black people, and then resistance to apartheid would grow. Right? And so really, going back into the late 1800s and carrying into the 20th century, but escalating in the 1940s during World War II, we see many, many work stoppages. Now, technically not strikes, because dock workers and Black workers aren't allowed to strike. But if everybody coordinates to not show up to work, that is a strike. But by law, these workers didn't have steady jobs. They had what was called casual work, meaning you were only hired by the day. So they weren't striking because they never had a job, right? They just chose to not report to work. But if everybody chooses to not to report to work, it has the same implication as a strike, without legally being a strike, because they were very clever in trying to work within the law to not therefore be fired and then sent back to their rural homes. Because if you were in South Africa, if you were a Black person and you didn't work for a white boss, you could be deported from the city back to your rural homeland where there was really even more abject poverty. And so in the 40s and 50s, there are almost every year, every other year, I should say, dock workers in Durban strike. And by the late 50s, 58, 59, these dock workers who are conducting what are referred to as stayaways, which is just another word of saying strike, are coordinating with the Afghan National Congress, the ANC. In other words, they're choosing not only to demand raises, but they're doing so in coordination with other workers and in support, in solidarity with the most well-known and largest anti-apartheid political group. Yeah. And so, this, therefore, it becomes pretty obvious, even though it, I think it was obvious the whole time, that these black workers' economic power, has profound political implications for the stability of the state to maintain racial oppression, aka apartheid. Yeah. And so, I'll stop there in case you want to wish a follow-up. I'm happy to also talk about San Francisco's solidarity actions with what was going on in South Africa.
Yeah, I think we're going to come to that in a second. We're going to be talking about a variety of things that ILWU has done over the decades in solidarity with various struggles. But just to turn once again, we're going to talk now about what you've called containerization and how the ILWU responded to it. And this is a process of, you're going to talk about it, but it has something to do with like the production process and basically how workers responded to that change of production. But I think what this really speaks to, what this gets at, is how will the ILWU and other workers, either organized or not, into labor unions, how will they respond to the coming onslaught of automation? There was just John Oliver just did a segment on automation a couple nights ago. It wasn't very good. But, you know, as a lot of studies have shown, at least, you know, half of jobs are going to be negatively impacted by automation. Kind of neoliberal society seems to be saying, well, you know, if you don't want to get replaced, you better learn how to code. It looks like the majority of truckers, this is something that, you know, we've said before on this podcast, but even in Bob Woodward's book, Fear, Trump in the White House, you know, Trump's economic advisors tell him that over the course of, you know, the next 8 years, that 25% of the workforce, which revolves around driving in some regards, which is, you know, of course, very connected to the ports and moving items out of the ports, is going to be automated. So they're going to have to deal with, you know, a massive amount of blue collar workers being automated out of the job industry. And like I was just seeing a news segment. I mean, if you're 55, if you're driving a truck, I mean, the idea that you're going to somehow transition to become a computer coder is just, I mean, it's just not going to happen.
you know, I was drawn to these subjects because my passion for and interest in really social movements and racial equality and anti-capitalism. But as I was doing more research, which was really going to be a whole book about anti-racism and transnational solidarity, I kept on running into this sort of funny thing called containerization. And ultimately, I came to appreciate that I would be stupid to ignore this subject, and I'd rather not be stupid. And so basically, in the late 50s and early 60s, the San Francisco dock workers and the entire West Coast dock worker union negotiated with their employers association to transition away from the traditional form of dock work, which is largely manual labor. Yeah, there's some tools involved, but really it's backbreaking gang labor, manual labor that hadn't changed so much for literally millennia, to a process where all cargo is often is loaded into metal boxes, standardized sizes, generally off pier, say at the warehouse or at a manufacturing site, moved by truck or rail to the harbor, and then using large cranes, ever larger cranes, loading and unloading metal boxes onto the tops of ships, right? And this is, and then of course offloaded onto the backs of 18-wheel trucks or railroads, etc. This becomes known as the logistics industry or the supply chain management industry, although you can just call it transportation. In the process, this technological process is called containerization, right? The process in which containers become the dominant form of movement of nearly all cargo around the world, raw materials and finished products. And literally the first union in the industry in the world that negotiated and that experienced these technological changes was the West Coast Dock Workers Union. With San Francisco being the biggest port, it was also the first place on the West Coast to really experience this. Now, this was also happening in New York City, which was bigger as a port. But in New York City, the East Coast Dock Workers, which has a much more a history of being more corrupt, more conservative, and more less radical and less militant, they refused to negotiate on it for a number of more years. And so in terms of a union contract, it's really the first place in the world, right? Now, what this union led by Harry Bridges, remember, he's a communist, supposedly, or at least a left-wing radical, does is he negotiates for what he calls a so-called share of the machine, saying, look, if this technology is going to result in massive increases in productivity, which means that employers are going to make more money, right, but also means, importantly for workers, there will be fewer of us. We want a share of the machine, i.e. some of the money, right? And we don't want to screw, as you noted, the older folks who will have a harder time transitioning. And so they also got basically a contract out of the employers in which they got guarantee that no one would be fired, not a single person. Instead, they would so-called shrink from the top, meaning what we would call early retirements. So the employers basically financed elder or older dock workers to leave the industry as opposed to firing people. Now, that was in some ways very logical and thoughtful, at least for that current generation of dock workers. Of course, subsequently over time, the numbers of workers will decline. The contrast with Durban is striking. In the late 70s, it happened much later there because it was less central to the global economy than the U.S., there was no powerful union. There was no union. The company and the state literally just created a new system and fired half the workforce, literally half the workforce in 3 years. Right. And so we first of all see the power of a union potentially at least to protect people, which is nothing to see that. Now, the larger implications of that are some of what you suggested. Right. More and more workers, whether you're blue collar, white collar, pink collar, if you got a collar, you're a worker, you're going to be affected by technological change. Right. Not just manual workers. And what can we do about that? Right. Now, I would say that technology is not necessarily a bad or a good thing, and that for many of us, technology is a beautiful thing. Right. We're talking to each other on Skype, which is a technology that makes our lives in some ways better. However, in the workplace, the question is who controls technology and who benefits from technology, right? And so I don't know if being a truck driver is a good or bad thing, but I know that that worker deserves to sort of have a decent living. Maybe not having truck drivers is not so bad. The problem is, do these people just end up on the streets suffering because some company, right, is reaping more profit. Technology is understandably fearful. Many workers are afraid of technological change because they don't have the power to basically control technological change. This union in San Francisco and the West Coast of America had some power, not total power. And they use that power on behalf of their members, which is not surprising. That helped them in a lot of ways. And I would add that dock workers today, although there are far fewer on the West Coast and around the world, they actually get paid very well and have strong protections, benefits, and whatnot. And so there's the particularities, yeah, of that. It's very fascinating and important to understand how this central industry to global capitalism is operating. But there's also the sort of the other implications, as you said, about thinking about how it is that workers across industries are impacted by technological change, not just containerization, but whatever the industry is, right? In my industry, education, online education has some potential benefits, but also could result in far fewer professors, right? It already is. And so I'm not a driver of a truck, but I am also affected by technological change. And so we should be mindful that it's really, I can't think of an industry that will not be impacted by technological change in the 21st century.
I saw a program on Canadian law school students, and they were saying that basically AI was going to be able to replace, law students that were looking up case files and stuff like that. So instead of, saying, hey, Timmy or Susie, go look up cases involving, hot coffee spilling on somebody and its implications, you would just type that into a machine and it would basically create something for you. There's actually an app, if you've been watching YouTube recently, there's a new app called Essay Bot that will literally write an essay for you and comb the internet and find site sources for you and stuff like that. It's pretty intense. So like you said, all these things are going to be affected. I think the thing to point out is that this is still under the regime of capital, this is still how, capitalism has been playing itself out in the recent period, is that corporations basically have been, wages have been stagnating. People have been working longer in hours for less and less money. We're still seeing a growth in output. So this is how they're being able to make more money, is that, they're cutting costs. The wages are stagnation. They're making more money that way. And automation, of course, is going to increase that, because if you have no workers working for you, if you just have robots, then you're going to make even more money. So.
Right. Well, I would say that, although much of my book is complementary, I think, of the IWU as a union, many of its members and often its leadership, including Harry Bridges, the containerization issue is actually more problematic, in my opinion. It's sometimes really not discussed, I think, in the union, though many people have discussions about what went on in 1961, except historians like me. But could Bridges and the union have done something different? In addition to getting a share of the machine and the shrinking from the top, which both make sense to me, what about actually spreading the work around so that there's more workers because we all work fewer hours, right? And so what the IWW started calling for, of course, in the 1920s and 30s is, forget about the 8-hour day, how about the 4-hour day? If there are so many billions of us who and we need to work, or I would also say that for many of us, work matters, right? We don't want to just be leisure. We maybe also want to sort of do something, right? What if we all worked 4 hours instead of 8 or 10 hours a day? That way, more people can work, right? Now, at the time in the early 60s, this was not a conversation that was seriously happening inside the IWU, despite the fact that there were many left-wing radicals in the union, right? That wasn't the conversation. Occasionally, the reduction of hours in the 1930s during the Great Depression, there was serious conversations in many industries about maybe some of the solution is actually sharing the work around by having fewer hours worked. Right now, who wouldn't want that, right? So in addition to the logic of that, there's the benefits, right? So why not we get the whole idea of technology as a labor-saving device, right? Is lost. Because so many people are afraid of technological change because they think the employers are going to reap all the benefits, which is understandable why they would fear that way. But if we had either government or if workers were powerful enough to negotiate these things, could we have, in fact, technological change that will benefit us because, well, we work fewer hours, so therefore we have more time to enjoy life, be better human beings and whatnot? The answer is yes. There's no reason we couldn't do that, except, well, there are those of us who want to, you know, extract profit from the others of us. But I think the key issue for our time, because it wasn't talked about in the 60s, is the issue of when technologies change, who benefits, and what are the specific ways we might share the benefits, not just the economic benefits, but also the time, right, for so many of us is so valuable. So I think that's another component of the conversation that we should be having now, right? As more technologies come in, it's not just who wins and who loses, but can we reduce hours of work? Why have we been stuck at the 40-hour week since the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act? Why not have a 20-hour week? Who wouldn't be in favor of that?
Well, obviously the bosses.
Obviously.
And, you know, we're not at a 40-hour week. I mean, we continue to work. I mean, especially American workers continue to work more and more hours, and people yes. working more and more precarious jobs. And, you know, as neoliberalism has advanced since the economic crisis of 2008, more and more people are working what they're calling freelance or in the gig economy, mm-hmm. where they're working several jobs, kind of piecing the life together. And in fact, you know, on the John Oliver special a couple nights ago about automation, they ran some clip from some, you know, university or think tank or whatever. And they were saying, like, you know, we need to start telling children as they're growing up, instead of, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? You know, what are the five things that you can do well that you could do mm-hmm. for money? Yes. And, I mean, just, you know, training children, training working class, kids, you know, as they go off into the world, you know, this is what your life is going to be like. It's, you know, you're going to mm-hmm. drive Uber, you're going to trim weed, you're going to, you know, do DoorDash, you're going to work at all these different crappy jobs, and you're going to try to put a life together as you spend right. more than half your income on rent mm-hmm. and hope that you have enough to pay off your health care and and school debts and stuff like that. So
right. I'd be depressed. Actually, I am depressed. But like, I mean, yes, it's the your scenario is, of course, the lived experience of millions of people. And even salaried workers like myself, who are lucky enough to have a single job. I don't work 40 hours a week. I work more. But I mentioned the 40 hours.
Oh, yeah. What's the average work week for something like yourself? 80 hours?
Well, I don't know. Honestly, I'd say at least 60.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I get paid well, and everything is relative. Have frequently noted to people that often people who have more than one job, you would think people with multiple jobs must be making more money. But we, of course, know it's the opposite, right? Those who have multiple jobs often just because they can't make enough at one job, right, to sort of survive.
Well, and also everybody that's, you know, juiced into a university, I mean, how many other people are there that are floating around either trying to find a job teaching, or I mean, I've met a lot of professors that are like, you know, I teach at this school and then I drive 3 hours this way to teach at this school, and they're I mean, talk about
yes. you know,
and they're basically making same amount if they were like subbing somewhere, you know. It's like, yes, I don't know, it's a lot.
Industry sucks. I mean, essentially I am one of the fortunate few. There are more students than ever before in university in America, mm-hmm. but there's actually fewer secure jobs, right? Like, so that may seem sort of to be a contradiction, except, of course, you've introduced the concept multiple times of neoliberalism. Universities operate the same way, right, as any other industry, in which, you know, so-called academic leaders, right, act no different than any other employer and try to extract maximum labor. That often means that you can exploit a surplus workers because there's a lot of beef out there. Yeah, I mean, it's like this industry that I am a part of is very much typical of the problems of 21st century capitalism. There's no question about it.
I mean, even like with coders and stuff like that. I mean, you know, today if you know how to code, if you can do certain things like that, I mean, you're almost kind of a skilled, specialized part of the workforce. But, you know, mm-hmm. then again, you know, 10 years into the future, if that becomes, you know, the new McDonald's job, we're going to see all the same things apply to that. And then what happens when those jobs start to, you know, go overseas so they can, you know, find, you know, a lower tier place to exist, you know, within the global economy. What happens, you know, what happens when that bubble bursts?
Yeah.
You know?
Yes,
all,
I hear you.
All of a sudden, all the Uber jobs are automated out of existence, and you can't code because they're all shipped off to Bangladesh. I mean,
right. So. Yes, I hear you. The key there, of course, is, you know, trying to sort of organize across different groups of people to prevent that. Easier said than done.
Right. Well, in that spirit, let's go forward. We've been talking a while now. It's been a great discussion, but let's at least talk about some of the instances in which the ILWU in the United States has been involved in solidarity struggles. You mentioned one that I think is a great example. It's probably one of the most recent, but the ILWU was involved to some capacity to in the so-called Block the Boat actions, mm-hmm. which were took place in the San Francisco Bay Area of Northern California. People blocked boats for the corporation Zim, I believe.
Yeah.
And they were an Israeli company. This is when Israel was heavily bombing Gaza.
Mm-hmm. So dock workers, not just in the two ports I study, but in many ports, because the issues that I've talked about in terms of dock workers becoming activists and often very international in their thinking is not surprising, given the industry they work in. But also there are specifics in the Bay Area due to a very left-wing oriented union, but also a lot by the 1960s, a black majority local 10. You have African-Americans and white Americans who are many of whom are sort of left in their orientation and led really by African-Americans, but with a lot of support for some key white allies in Local 10 and other Bay Area locals. They increasingly became sympathetic to the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, and so on a number of occasions refused to work cargo from South Africa in order to protest apartheid in South Africa. And most dramatically in 1984, just after Reagan's reelection, where for 10 days dock workers in San Francisco refused to work a Dutch cargo ship full of South African cargo. And in 1990, when Nelson Mandela spoke in Oakland as part of a tour of America right after he was released from Robben Island, he spent 10% of his speech talking about that action and thanking those dock workers and others. Fast forward into the recent times, occasionally dock workers continue to use the same tactics for similar but different issues. Many South Africans actually are very very critical, I should say, of Israel for its treatment of Palestinians, and frequently are the ones who use the term that Palestine suffers from apartheid. Many people sympathetic to Israel really sort of, you know, hate that comparison. And there are some indifferences. Nevertheless, the fact that South Africans are frequently the ones using this parallel is not insignificant. Many Americans are also sympathetic to the Palestinian struggle for independence. And as you noted, Israel on multiple occasions, having most all the power, have frequently bombed really the prisoners in Gaza, upwards of 2 million people who live in a postage stamp and have very little power. Israel has a shipping company called Zim, Z-I-M, that occasionally sort of docks in American ports. And in 2010, but also in 2014, activists picketed the Zim line ships as they docked in Oakland. And those activists in 2014, many of whom were Arab Americans, but who had coordinated with members of Local 10, basically set up a community picket line. And then the dock workers say that they don't want to cross that picket line and respect this picket. And therefore, the ship, which it's in the time, as you said, when Israel is bombing the crap out of Palestinian civilians for the most part, is unable to unload. I should say also that in Durban, South African dock workers have also protested against Israeli policies in similar ways. But this has also happened in some other ports in Northern and Southern Europe. And so Block the Boat was the nickname for it in 2014. And it's another example of how dock workers, but this, of course, other workers could do something similar, have exerted power to express a political agenda, right, or to support a political issue. They don't do all this all the time by any means, and it's often a temporary action. But it's, I think, for many of us, quite impressive. I should also note that in South Africa, Durban dock workers have engaged in the same sort of tactics. In 2008, much of one chapter of my book explores how they refused to unload military weapons and ammunition from China out of Durban that would have been loaded onto trucks and shipped to the landlocked country of Zimbabwe, which in 2008 was in the midst of a violent election cycle where the president, now the former president, Robert Mugabe, was using military and police power to prevent a democratic election from going forward, right? And so that Durban dock workers have also engaged in solidarity activism on behalf of Black people in another country, in this case, their neighboring country, Zimbabwe. And so there are other examples in other parts of the world that are similar. And in the Bay Area, dock workers in the late 70s were refusing to work U.S. military cargo that might be loaded onto ships to go to Pinochet in Chile, although my book doesn't explore that issue. And so it's a fascinating example of really the internationalism of workers in this industry and the power that they potentially have when organized well.
Are you following what's been going on in Matamoros, Mexico, the past couple weeks?
I'm afraid not. I know what that place is, and that is a border town with maquiladoras, but I don't know what you're referring to.
Tens of thousands of people that have gone on strike, and it's been interesting because some of the workers are working at plants that supply parts for like GM factories, which in the U.S. and Mexico are about to be shipped out to Mexico. So they've like gone to the border and like issued statements saying, you know, American workers, their chant is "Gringos wake up," but they've issued statements saying, you know, join us on strike, you know, resist these job closures. You know, we're all part of the same global supply chains. You know, we should be fighting together instead of, you know, viewing ourselves as workers locked within national borders, which, of course, capital can easily cross.
Right. I mean, the issue is time and again that capital can move easily across invisible national boundaries, but humans are legally not allowed to. And so the problem with capital has gamed, of course, they helped design the system, right? Like, it's a problem, right? Because, like, how do you organize workers across borders? Well, it's actually very hard because every country has a different set of laws, and humans are obligated to respect those laws, even though corporations can often flaunt them. And so I don't have an answer to that one. I just am aware, first we identify the problems, right? Then we maybe identify solutions. The ILWU has done something interesting in recent years. They actually have organized a few years ago the dock workers in Panama. So now ILWU represents U.S. West Coast, including Hawaii and Alaska, British Columbia dock workers, as well as Panamanian ones. Now they have different contracts, but it's actually the most impressive example of workers in a single union. Dock workers, along with rail workers, truck workers, sailors, and whatnot, are also part of what's called the International Transport Workers Federation. So it's the transport industry work. Now, that's a union of sorts, but really it has no power to negotiate contracts, right? It's more of a way to exchange information and to make people familiar with each other so that they can organize together across these traditional boundaries. And in South Africa and in the United States, these dock workers know each other now. They didn't know each other, say, in 1984, but in the 21st century, these guys and some gals are very much a part of a international organization that they occasionally, for instance, attend conferences and are able to get to know each other now in order to try to strategize, even though we've just talked about the real problems that that exist.
One really interesting idea, one interesting question that I had was that, what was the interplay between either Black liberation thinkers, groups, movements outside of the unions on dock workers themselves? Did that, was there any seizable or foreseeable interplay? Did any particular group or figure or movement have like a real direct correlation or impact on dock workers themselves? You know, was there any instance of people coming together across, you know, different group lines or something like that? I'm just curious.
Sure. Well, I am too. One of my research areas that I, when I began this project, was I figured that there was going to be a lot of connections between Local 10 and the Black Panthers because, well, in Oakland, which is where most black dock workers lived, they were in some ways the most powerful, best paid, organized workers in Oakland. Simultaneously, you've got the rise of the Panthers in the mid-60s. It's not that big a place, right? West and North Oakland, South Berkeley. In fact, they did know each other. I was able to dig up a few tantalizing tidbits where, like, this one bar that a dock worker owned that, in fact, was a Panther hangout. But what I discovered to my dismay or whatever was that, in fact, there wasn't a lot of overlap, that the Panthers were really organizing the so-called man on the corner or the street, which they often refer to as the lumpin' proletariat, who are essentially, in Marxist ideas, essentially they're disorganized workers and often underemployed people, right? And so even though they're all hanging out in West Oakland, right, and even though they share a left politics, an anti-capitalist politics, and often an internationalist one, there was far less overlap, even though I talked to and got to know a number of really radical left-wing African-Americans from Oakland, right, who were dock workers. They, in fact, weren't sort of coordinating their efforts with the Huey Newton or Bobby Seale or any of those guys. So that ended up being a research dead end. So too in Durban, where you've got all these black dock workers who are in, I argue, really the single best organized, most militant group of black people in Durban, the third biggest city in South Africa in the, say, late 60s and early 70s. Who else is in Durban at that time? A famous black man named Steve Biko. Biko is so-called father of black consciousness and is often compared to Malcolm X in the United States. Tremendously influential, not really a political figure because he's talking about how black people have to liberate their minds from essentially internalized white supremacy, political, but lowercase p, not electoral. And Biko's in Durban at this time, but he's a medical student and he comes out of really sort of an elite, if you will, black educated group, a very small number. Even though he has a humble background. Biko wasn't trying to organize and his allies weren't really sort of thinking about organizing black workers in Durban. Even though this becomes known as the Durban moment in South Africa because you have simultaneously rising black worker power as well as the emergence of black consciousness in Durban and then spreading around South Africa. So in both places, you don't really see these, as you called it, black liberation thinkers, whether it's Huey or Biko, having a lot of impact in or connections to dock workers in either of these places. However, if we go back one generation, Paul Robeson, who was really, in a way, the most important African-American activist of the mid-20th century, an actor, a singer, and an activist, I often say it would be like if Kanye West and Denzel Washington, right, were in the same body, but they were also a left-wing Pan-Africanist, right? Robeson is an honorary member of Local 10. Some of his best friends are in the IW. He very much is thinking in these ways, but he is red-baited to death by the early 50s, right? And so there are actually a number of Local 10 and other Bay Area workers in the IW who I know love Robeson. But they're younger than Robeson, right? They look to him in a way as a impressive figure, right? So they're influenced by Robeson more than anyone else, right? The Panthers, for instance, in Oakland or the BC black consciousness scene in South Africa don't have overt influence upon either group of dock workers that I have to study.
Well, we thank you for taking so much time to talk about your book. Is there anything else that you want to touch on? Or at least tell us where we can get a copy of this new book.
Well, it's been my pleasure to talk with you. Of course, you could purchase this book through the University of Illinois Press website, where you don't have to go to a big corporation to buy it. But if you do go to a bookstore, or if you buy online, Powell's Books in Portland, Oregon, right? Actually, the workers in that union, that workplace, are members of the IW also, Local 5.
Right? Oh, wow.
So you could buy this book about IW Local 10 from a workplace that has an organized workforce in Local 5, right? And that would be appropriate. Depending on when this runs, you know, I'll be giving a number of talks in the Bay Area the week of like March 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th. including in the Mission on Wednesday night, March 13th at Shaping SF, a wonderful community history group. And all these events are free and open to the public. And if you get on that internet thing, you could probably find those talks advertised there, but also on the University of Illinois Press website.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us. It's been fascinating, and it's great to uncover this history, especially at a time when, you know, discussions around across borders, people taking action is so needed against white supremacy and capitalism.
Well, it's my pleasure again. And I, of course, see the relevance of this historical subject to our contemporary situation, and in particular, sort of rising activism, coordinated activism against white supremacy, but also really against capital. And so if you're interested in those things, knowing a bit about these Durban and San Francisco Bay Area dock workers, well, I think they would be both interesting and important for people to know more about.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.